This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Lewis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm digging into the archives to share an event which centered on the life, career, impact of the late John Hume. And I'm sharing this because of the sad news of recent days that Pat Hume, the widow of John, has died. John Hume, of course, was the late SDLP leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner. Pat Hume had worked alongside her husband from the beginning of the civil rights movement in Derry in the 1960s. And her work continued during the Troubles through the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. She ran John's Foyle constituency office dealing with community issues, housing and poverty in Derry. And it's clear that she was a focal point, a centre point of the family. They released a statement saying that they were heartbroken to announce her death, adding that she, quote, died as she lived, surrounded by family, peacefully and generous to the end. So the event that I'm sharing took place in 2019. It's pre-pandemic, obviously. And it took place in the context of Maurice Fitzpatrick's wonderful documentary film on John Hume in America. We convened, as is our good fortune at NYU, of being able to tap into a fantastic array of voices, experts, commentators. On the panel that day, we had Ted Smith, former diplomat and businessman, president of the board of Glucksman Ireland House, kind of moderating the session. We had the former Consul General of New York, Ciarán Madden. We had renowned award-winning author, Colm Tobin. And we had one of the great chroniclers of Irish America and the American experience more generally, Mary Pat Kelly. Now, in that event, we're discussing John Hume in America. And to use the old adage, which has been bandied about a lot over recent days, behind every good man and successful man, there's a woman there in the wings. And I kind of hate using that hackneyed term or adage in this context, but truly, by all accounts, I'd never had the good fortune of meeting Pat Hume or indeed the late John Hume. But from everything I hear, and we hear it in this panel that I'm sharing with you today, Pat Hume was an absolute force behind the work of John Hume. And in that sense, by extension, what we see in Northern Ireland today in terms of a place that is largely void of conflict. And there are explicit and implicit references to Pat throughout this panel. And I don't have anything in the archive that captures Pat herself. And in the classic sense of many couples like this, to a greater extent, John was the public face of his activities and the spokesperson for the activities. But I run this panel, this archival piece with you in tribute to Pat knowing, of course, that she would not mind the tribute it pays, of course, to John as well. Pat has died rather suddenly after a short illness. She was very devoted. Anyone familiar with the life of John Hume will know that he was ill for a very protracted period. And indeed, the humility that was shown by Pat in his illness and her steadfast support is remarkable. Her passing, you know, it is one of those announcements that shocks people. You know, she was just someone who was always there in the background, and for the world to lose her so soon, in a way after John, is indeed a great loss. And the tributes that have poured in for Pat speak to the esteem in which she was held, the esteem in which she and John were held as a couple, and their role essentially in Irish history. Not least, President Michael D. Higgins was quoted as saying, "Mrs. Hume had made," and I quote, "an extraordinary contribution to life on this island and beyond, and her work would," quote, "always have an indelible place in the minds of all Irish people." He continued, "Her life," he said, "was one of total commitment to community, to the possibilities of peace, to the measures of non-violence that were necessary to assert, vindicate and achieve the results of civil rights." Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, also commented, "Pat Hume was a gracious, determined force behind the achievement of peace in Ireland. She and her husband John both made the world a better place and set an example for us all, sending my condolences to her family." The head of the Catholic Church in Ireland, Archbishop Eamon Martin, said, "Mrs. Hume was Derry's first lady and a friend to all who suffered during troubled times." And Taoiseach Micheál Martin praised the tremendous contribution the Humes made to peace and stability on this island, and he noted Mrs. Hume's resilience and courage on the path to peaceful change. She was Mr. Hume's partner in family life and in political life, his trusted advisor at key political moments, and his anchor in their beloved Derry. So it's a privilege indeed to be able to share these reflections of John and Pat, and there's particular emphasis on this in terms of the Hume footprint in the United States, which is very appropriate for this Irish-American life. And I'm delighted to be able to share it with you here today. And I know that behind the scenes, for people who are intimately connected to the family, obviously personal condolences have been extended or being extended. But just to publicly, on behalf of us all here at Luxembourg Ireland House, to extend our sympathies to the Hume family on this great loss, and to remark on the legacy in terms of the ripple effect of this news that Pat has passed away. Not many families, not many couples, not many individuals leave a mark in the way that John and indeed Pat Hume have, and we can only hope that the family take comfort in that legacy and in those memories when their sadness has somewhat diminished in time. As they say, time is a healer. We are back on campus at NYU, folks. Our classes have resumed in person. We're tentatively making our steps towards a return to normality, and we're planning our programs for now online in the virtual space for the foreseeable future while we see how things settle back in. And I will be announcing, we've started publishing some of our events for the fall. They're on our website if you just want to put Luxembourg Ireland House NYU in the search engine and click into our homepage. You'll see some of the events. Our events start on September 16th. And I'll be talking more about them in due course as well, of course. And We've some great events lined up, and we're planning a wonderful conference in November, and we hope that you will engage with the work we continue to do at Luxman Ireland House. But as I said, today we are pausing. We're thinking about the legacy of Pat Hume in the context of her passing with little notice after a short illness this week in Derry. And we jump back into the archives to hear from some of the best of our public intellectuals and commentators that we have the good fortune of interacting with here at NYU on an ongoing basis. So as we think about, as I say, the loss of this great woman and this great couple now in that sense, we can celebrate and mark their wonderful achievements in life. And what an outstanding role model in terms of a couple who supported each other all the way. Handing over now to our panel on John Hume in America.
Please give another round of applause. I'm going to introduce this fabulous panel very briefly, and then we'll get to a few fire starter questions, and then we'll get to your questions. On my left here, Maurice Fitzpatrick has previously directed The Boys of St. Columns and a documentary on Brian Friel's translations. I highly recommend his book, John Hume in America, which will be republished by University of Notre Dame this May. Consul General Kieran Madden has been Consul General of Ireland since 2017, a native of Cork, don't hold that against him. He's been Irish Government Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Ambassador to the Emirates, Director for the Irish Abroad Unit. And Mary Pat Kelly is author of Irish Above All, a highly recommended novel that showcases the tumultuous years of the 20th century through the experiences of an indomitable Irish-American woman, not surprisingly called Nora Kelly. As a filmmaker, her credits include Proud and three award-winning PBS documentaries, including To Live for Ireland, A Portrait of John Hume and His Party. And Colm Tobin has done more in a lifetime than an entire university humanities faculty. A novelist, the fabulous Brooklyn Nora Webster, for starters, editor of McGill magazine, playwright, critic, poet, professor of humanities at Columbia, and chancellor of the University of Liverpool. So, okay, let's get right to it. In 2010, John Hume was named Ireland's greatest in an RTE poll to find the greatest person in Ireland's history. Colm, you wrote Bad Blood, A Walk Along the Border, and it was 1980s, and as a journalist and writer, you met Hume and you covered him. For you, what makes Hume stand out as a leader and persuader of the caliber we saw in the movie?
Patience. That in those years when I did that book where I walked along the border and I went back, you know, over the next few years, he could not be found. No one knew where he was. It was one summer particularly where a game began. You know, where is John Hume? And, you know, it was a very difficult time. It was after the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And the Anglo-Irish Agreement may have made a difference to Dublin and Belfast at a government level, at a civil servant level. But on the ground in the north, especially after, for example, the Enniskillen bombing, it just looked as though this was an intractable political situation that would not go away. If you were working as a journalist, you found when you went to Belfast, there was almost no one from the SDLP, Hume's party, that you could see or would be worth seeing. Whereas if you went into West Belfast, you know, the sheer interest in which everything Danny Morrison had to say was for a journalist was really extraordinary. As the other members of Sinn Féin, both in Belfast and in Derry, if you went to the council meetings in Derry, the dreadful, long, interminable Monday night wrangling that would happen in the council. You see, the Sinn Féin guys were hungry. They were starting their careers. They were of interest. There was a tiredness, even then in the 80s, about the SDLP. It looked as though no one had any ideas. I remember having a conversation with someone who I would have considered, you know, one of the most significant figures in the North at a cultural level. it was a private conversation. I just can't say who it is, but he just said to me, John's not thinking anymore. He has nothing new. He's not thinking. And it looked like that circa 85, 80, sorry, 86, 87, 88, as those years went on, that there was going to be no way out of this. So that what he did by not trying earlier, by not trying at the wrong moment, by catching things as they came, like a great sports like a great sports person, knowing the moment to go, was an extraordinary achievement. And also the sort of mystery he created about himself, which was Parnellite. No one knew where Parnell was. He was in Brighton, but no one knew that. And the sense also of being able to, what I think is significant, what Bertie Ahern said. Bertie was very good always on electoral politics. If you can't get elected, don't talk. And the fact that Hume could be elected to the European Parliament, which was extraordinary majorities, and to Westminster, and when there were elections in Northern Ireland, that he actually held his own people with him all the way, that he did what Parnell did. He managed to put an umbrella up over himself which would cover a number of other people with whom he didn't quite agree, that he could represent Derry, where he clearly understood how much he could say, how far he could move, while still bringing everybody with him. And so that achievement as a politician in electoral politics, the number of elections John Hume won is really extraordinary. Yeah. Yeah. But the second thing is knowing the moment to move and how to do it, and also knowing the great opposition there was going to be to this at government level, as you know, but also at journalists were really, people I was working with, were astonished and appalled that this leader of constitutional nationalism in Ireland was going to sit down with the devil, with the people who had bombed Enniskillen and killed, just to take that example, but we could take many other ones, and who were always ready to put a car bomb into the equation, and to sit down with them to say, you and me will speak as equals. Well, there were people who didn't think that was right, and it was very hard to explain. There was a very difficult year where every time Hume was in Dublin, he was explaining himself, he was defending himself. It might have been different in Washington, but in Dublin it wasn't like that. No. I remember one night in the Shelburne Hotel watching him, this is 1893, where he looked awful. He looked disheveled and he was in an awful state, and he was defending himself in the bar of the Shelburne Hotel to a number of people, including myself, who were idiots.
Yeah, it was a very selfless act because it was going against his own political interest and that of his party, and yet he was doing it for the country, and he was doing it out of pure patriotic motives. Mary Pat, Seamus Heaney wrote in the Irish Times, when I knew John Hume in St. Columb's and Derry in the 50s, you had the impression of somebody reliable and consistent who operated from a principled and definite mental center, sort of thing that Colm's been talking about. What were your impressions of John when you met him in the 70s and you worked for Good Morning America?
This was a very emotional experience, and I thank you very much, Morris, for getting this all together and some of the historical footage. I think the intensity of what went on, now that there is peace, I know there's problems, but people aren't being shot. When you see them walking over the Peace Bridge, when I first came to Derry, there were no restaurants, there were no movie theaters, there were no shops. I mean, the buildings were being held up by 2x4s. Life had stopped, but when I first met John, and this is a perfect time to tell that story, because I was working at Good Morning America. We were all so young. You know, we were all in our 20s and early 30s, and I was working at Good Morning America. I'd gone to NYU Film School. I was very proud of being Irish, being from Chicago. You know, in Chicago, they ask you, are you 100% Irish? Because that's the best. And I have a little German, but if you're Mary Pat Kelly, you don't have to explain you're Irish. But I realized I had very little understanding. And in Chicago, as opposed to maybe the East, there wasn't much support for the IRA. It was more like Northern Ireland, oh, well, you know, let's hope that it gets solved. But nobody had a rooting interest. And then came John Hume. And in 1976, Ted, I was working at Good Morning America, and he introduced me to John as a different voice about Ireland in general, Irish history too, not just Northern Ireland, what it meant to be Irish. And I was very excited, and I went to the head producer, and I said, we'd like to have this wonderful statesman talk about Northern Ireland. And he actually said to me, oh, Northern Ireland, if you bring me somebody and a ski mask and a gun, maybe, you know, maybe we'll do something. It was only the extremes. But I had my own segment called Face Off, where I would get two people to argue an issue. And I was not about, I'm from Chicago, so I wasn't about tipping the scale in my favor. So I said to Ted, look, here's what we'll do. We'll come with a very, very nebulous question. Should there be peace in Northern Ireland, or how should there be peace? And Mr. Hume can simply state his opinions, and we'll get somebody very weak on the other side. So, because we had the best ratings. We were beating the Today Show. What politician wouldn't want to come on and speak to, 40 million people? The politician who didn't want to come on was John Hume. So Ted came back and said, Mr. Hume says Northern Ireland is too complicated to reduce to a yes-no. And I see Paul Arthur, who's a fabulous historian of all of this, nodding his head. So that got me interested, and ultimately then I would do my own PBS documentary. And I think for Americans, for Irish Americans, I had been active in the civil rights movement, had certainly loved the Kennedys, that kind of shining idealism of what being an Irish American meant, the Democratic Party, that it was for inclusion. And then we came to this horrible time in our politics where it wasn't happening anymore. And here came John Hume, who just embodied, it was so, the fact that I told him that I'd actually marched in civil rights marches, that I'd been at Resurrection City, he really got the Martin Luther King, that really there was no way forward through hatred. And of course then the famous speech he would always give, that all conflict is based on difference, right? And that if you can accommodate difference, then there's no need for conflict, which applies to everything. And then the title of my documentary, which he always said, before Irish patriotism used to be to die for Ireland. And he said, I want our young people to live for Ireland. And it happened, and we saw it happen, and he did it. But I think one reason why you see all these American politicians, because he appealed to that deep down part of ourselves that were formed by the civil rights movement, that did want, and actually it's happening right now, that Ireland is a more inclusive, more progressive society than we are.
Yeah.
I mean, the Taoiseach took his boyfriend to meet Mike Pence. I mean, yay, So, I mean, but what he did, and when you were talking about him being really, I mean, the most depressed, Martin, my husband Martin, is actually from Northern Ireland. He actually knew what was going on, The most depressed, I remember seeing him in the Aer Lingus lounge, with his head in his hands in the newspapers, just terrible things. But what he said to us was, if I can save one life by talking to one person, the Steeltown bomb really hit him hard. He went to those funerals, and the people would come up to him and say, John, stop this, do something. And he felt if he could talk to Gerry Adams, and he knew President Clinton was very right, and it's happening. He knew this probably was ending the SDLP in the kind of...
Sure.
When I first went, like, I would disagree with one thing. In those years in the 80s, 85, 86, 87, that's when SDLP was winning elections. I mean, they won by a great majority. The first time Sinn Féin contested election, everybody was telling me, oh, Sinn Féin's going to, run over them. No, the SDLP won. And Pat Hume opened the constituency office in Derry and in all these places where the SDLP won. So they started to really serve the needs of the people. Sinn Féin was great in talk and talking to journalists, but they weren't so good about getting your coal delivered or getting somebody out of prison. And it was women. It was the women. It was Pat Hume. First of all, they supported their husbands. Gertrude Mallon was a nurse. That's how they put food on the table. Pat was teaching. And the first time I went canvassing with the SDLP, like, I think it was the European Parliament election, and the women, and it's very hilly in Derry, and there's cobblestones, and they had like 3-inch heels on, the women, And we would canvass, and then people would go home and put the, the roast beef on, and then come back out. And they were so brave. SDLP canvassers were shot to death on people's doorsteps. I mean, in fact, we were talking about this journalist. I was in a car where the IRA, pointed rifles at us. Luckily, the driver knew how to back up at 60 miles an hour. But these were ordinary people, and I think that's what Hume did do, that there was an atavistic connection with him. He was the chieftain, and there was a feeling that he was connected to the people. He always said the only reason why he succeeded was because at age 11, he passed an exam. And he tells the story of the boy that sat next to him that didn't pass the exam to go on to school, that killed himself later. You know, he just had a real sense of being connected to the people, and still does, with all the tragedy of, and sadness of his condition. I've just talked to his daughter. He's the emperor of the nursing home. Everybody is coming up to him, and, you know. So it was an extraordinary thing. But the women of Derry, the women of the SDLP, were really the workers on the ground. And I think maybe when he was not appearing more forcefully, they were laying the network and also connecting to the Sinn Féin, so that it wasn't this terrible divide, because there was all the families. You had people on both sides.
So thanks for Sorry, that. Thanks for that, Mary Pat. So coming back to, it was the Americans who made me do it, we saw in the movie, Consul General. Let's take it up to today. Is there still an Irish-American card to play to protect the peace in Northern Ireland from possible Brexit opposition?
Say three things. Firstly, I want to thank Morris. I think the more we can get this film seen, the better, because, as has been noted, John isn't available to tell his own story. The SDLP isn't as strong as it is to tell the story, and the story should be told, and on the sign that goes back for pre-98 and pre-88 and pre-78 needs to be told. John Hume didn't create Irish America, but he mobilised it for the good of the North. And when I was coming over here, people said Irish America is dead. Mm-hmm. And then you can see in the last 6 months that Irish America, when faced with a crisis, which is now Brexit, and the threat that Brexit could make to the peace in Northern Ireland, suddenly it came together again. As is there, and you've heard statements from Richie Neal and others to that effect. But we shouldn't have to rely on crises. And looking ahead from now, so we'll deal with Brexit over the next few weeks. And I say we have US friends and allies on that. But looking ahead to what Irish America can mean in the future, we do need to rethink it. We do need to look at it differently. Ireland is different. You know, 17% of the people in Ireland weren't born on the island. Go back to what Mary Pat was saying, and the influence that the civil rights marchers in this country had. The African American civil rights marchers could be had on John Hume and those around him. We find ways to build connections that are beyond the blue people like me, the blue white people like me. And we've had this conversation with Mary Pat, I've had this conversation with Miriam Lyon from Dublin Ireland House. Irish America needs to be a different Irish America 10 years hence and 20 years hence. And we shouldn't have to rely on crises to mobilise it. But for the moment, in crisis, I think we can.
Thanks very much. And turning to our esteemed director, so you've had great success with this movie. How do we bluntly get it on PBS nationwide? What can we do to help?
By being blunt, I think it would be wonderful to have this up on American public television. And I do think that there's an appetite when I've showed this all around in the United States special screens. We had one particular screening in the United States Congress, which was really memorable for me because it was another instance of what Barack Obama was talking about, the bipartisanship. It was hosted by a Democrat and a Republican congressman, and indeed by the Irish ambassador at that time. And I think it is a narrative that isn't widely seen or understood in Irish America, just simply because time has passed, but there's also a vigorous revisionism occurring and a vigorous tendency to say, well, this year, let's say pick a year, 1998 or 2006 when the St. Andrews Agreement was signed, this is the year after that, that's what you know, that's what you need to know. Whereas what I suppose this film is trying to assert is you need to go right back to the roots, back in 64, before there was even a civil rights movement in the North. This was, there was a person, John Hume, trying to formulate an entirely new strategy. And I think it's very important for Irish America to understand that. And also to maybe appreciate the consistency of his message. And I would love if this would get widely discussed, and I think in my experience of trying to get do films, there's no substitution for television. I mean, RTE in Ireland, BBC in Britain and Northern Ireland, but PBS here, it seemed to me. So what's required, I suppose, a little bit of money and a little bit of PBS interest.
So I understand, Consul General, that the Irish government is putting up some seed money to support this, and I think we'll hope to do a fundraiser generally. So if any of you have good ideas, come up and talk to us afterwards. BBC is going to show it, which will be terrific. It's not that the British need a better understanding of Northern Ireland. They totally get it, right? At least judging by the House of Commons debate. Colm, I know you have to go to another meeting shortly. So the EU, John identified the EU as the best framework, as a very important framework for peace in Ireland. What's your feeling on, you know, how important that remains to peace in Ireland?
John Hume had a wonderful speech where he talked about being in Europe and going as a member of the European Parliament and walking across that bridge in Strasbourg between France and Germany and realizing, hold on, France and Germany, you know, of all the trouble in the 20th century, well, they caused it. And at least one side did and the other. Anyway, you know what I mean. And but that had become the coal and steel agreement and then the EU and, you know, the common market. And surely, if this could happen, and I suppose that for us in Ireland matters enormously, to have watched that we could join Europe as an equal partner and that we could, as was mentioned here, sit at a table with the British minister, supporting them in various ways, getting to know them, and that mattered enormously in the creation of the peace process. And I think it mattered enormously to us, a really bad business, when Britain, because it isn't in the euro, could not support us in the crisis over our banking because they weren't at the meetings. And that for us was a bad business, because having an ally, which Britain has been our ally in a great number of areas. So, I mean, for us, this is, I think it's something, and I think, Mark, you'd be aware of this and seeing in the film, Hume was a great visionary in the sense that European ideal fascinated him, intrigued him, and he saw the future in that context. So what's happening now, and I mean the Brexit is for us not only a disaster in this short-term economic way, but it's a disaster in that a great vision about creating peace and harmony and indeed economic prosperity within Europe seems to be undermined by our own nearest neighbour. And that is obviously something that goes against, I think, everything John Hume worked for, and that this film, I think, shows brilliantly the sort of just the, you know, you begin with three principles, and if you apply those three principles to every moment in your political career, you can actually prevail, which I think Clinton talks about. You know, this man was real. When he talked about peace, he wasn't talking about something else he wanted. No, he wanted that. And but at the moment, we're going through, I mean, just watching the mother of parliaments, I mean, behaving like a rabble. And when people in the future talk about British intelligence, I mean, they would really, really have to bathe that in great irony, because we're not seeing it.
It's another oxymoron.
You know, who's irrational now? Who's Paddy now? And it's not funny, but I mean, there are moments where you would have to laugh.
Thank you for that, Colm.
Can I briefly just follow up on something Colm said there? A photograph I ended up using in the book with Paisley and Hume together working in Europe. I had to come up with a caption, and I seem to recall I said something like, adversaries at home, allies in Europe. These were two constituency politicians. They understood that they had to deliver to their constituents, and they worked together in Europe. And like you saw the segment of Paisley, it's not as though there weren't some problems in trying to, you know, collaborate with this man. But they managed to do that in Europe. Take that European dimension away, and you're faced with something very, very poisonous.
Thank you. Questions from the audience. I know that you've been sitting patiently, and many of you must be bursting with things to say or comment.
Could before Colm leaves, could I just say that image that you just presented of the bridge and Hume standing there and realizing that 50 million people had died and now the two adversaries were allies, and, you know, couldn't we, and also, we'll talk about this later, but language, I'd love to hear what you say about his language, because that kept coming up. Here was someone who meant what he said. So that image of that bridge, maybe we can hold on to it and hope that somehow they'll see sense. But thanks, thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you very much.
So, any wisdom from the hall here? There's a mic roving around if anybody wishes to ask a question. Do I see anyone out there? Miriam's coming up. Here's
use Colin's mic, maybe you'll win a prize.
You got eloquence with the mic.
So I had what I think is a very quick question. I grew up here in the United States as a child.
Is the mic on?
You have to really go close to it.
Try it now.
There you are.
Yeah.
So I grew up here in the United States, parents of two Irish, or child of two Irish parents. And I remember in the early civil rights troubles, there was John Hume was at Bryntollet Bridge. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that bridge theme could be very instrumental in a PBS connection. If I remember, he was, well, there was considerable violence. Anyway, just a thought on the PBS connection.
It was the PBS.
It was probably footage you left on the floor.
Yeah, it was a PBS march.
He wasn't involved with that.
Very much two students, and I think Farrell was very much involved with it. Yeah. But, yeah, bridges generally are very important symbols in any divided society. So I think the more we can...
President McAleese made a theme of her two terms, bridges, and then they commemorated that by naming the bridge after her in Drogheda.
Yeah. Over here, we have a question. Just, it should be turned on if you push it up.
There we go. Thank you for this wonderful forum, by the way. This is great insight into a wonderful man. I'm wondering, did he have a relationship with Martin McGuinness and how that may have helped his decision and how he was thinking about bringing together Sinn Féin?
He didn't have the strongest relationship with Martin McGuinness. There were political rivals. John Hume consistently topped the polls in Derry. And when he started to build this bridge, to continue with the metaphor, it was with, as you saw in the film there, Gerry Adams, more than with McGuinness. And at the same time, they had a convivial enough relationship, they were able to speak to each other. Derry, for all its political issues, Derry is a very friendly place, but there wasn't the strongest. Would you agree with that, Paul? It wasn't the strongest relationship.
This is Paul Arthur.
Professor Paul Arthur.
Come up, Paul.
No.
He's a real daring man.
I think that Morris is right and wrong. There was a famous conference in Derry in 1992 called Beyond Hate. What they did was they brought people from other conflicts to share their experiences. And some of the people there were, for example, hostages in Beirut, but people from around the world. Martin McGuinness was there, and that was deliberate. And he would not have been there had Hume not given his permission. Because this is the first public occasion when Sinn Féin come out from the cold. And I remember talking to McGuinness a few years later when we were trying to put something together in 1995, and he said to me, well, how does this compare with 1992? And I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, the only important thing about 1992 was that you were there. And he said, that's right. So they had the strategy from early on that they needed to get involved. And certainly there would have been rivalry between McGuinness and Hume. But Hume always realized these guys had to be brought in, and that's what he was doing on that occasion.
Paul has been the chair of the Civil Rights Anniversary this year, very important anniversary, and has led it brilliantly. Any other questions from the folks?
I have a question here from the back. I'm interested in this notion of patience. From what I see from the film, that John Hume had this notion and plugged away at it for, by my count, about 30 years. And I'm so sorry that there wasn't more of the human dimension in the documentary so that we could see what he had to endure personally to get through this long slog that seemed so unpromising for so long. And I just wonder, on the personal dimension, who knows how he endured this for all that time?
It's a very good question. Thanks for that, John. And Morris, you'd be best able to answer that, and it also clearly affected his health, too.
Yeah, that's right. In conducting interviews for this, I steered content as far as I could towards politics and kept it there, politics and history and policy. And quite spontaneously, many, if not all, of the principals in the film wanted to get on record what kind of man John Hume was. And they were very, very honest. Many people had very fine things to say about him. But also, I mean, you heard Malin there, you know, the way he could be a slightly difficult colleague from Malin's point of view. That human dimension is certainly fascinating about Johnny, and I'm fascinated, but it's just not the approach I chose to take in this documentary. Who is best able to articulate, of course, Pat Hume, who was and is John Hume's wife all these years. I think they were nearly 60 years married or something, and five children. She organized and led the SDLP office in Derry City all those years, and she really understood the kind of pressures he was under. And Charlie Doherty said something quite interesting to me, and I was very happy to include in the film, that Hume was under pressure from all sides. Whereas when Doherty went back to the Great Northeastern in Philadelphia, you know, he was faced with basically the Teamsters Union and NORAID, who saw him as a quisling, saw him as a fellow traveller with Britain and with British policy, whereas Hume at various times would have been seen, even from the get-go, those 1964 articles, he would have been seen as someone who's not patriotic enough, you know, advocating to accept the Northern Irish state and work within it to transcend this border. You know, that would have been heretical from some people's point of view. So he had a capacity to withdraw and understood various different threats he was under and could be quite, quite defensive. Occasionally, some of the journalists I spoke to for the film, occasionally you get somebody who, a journalist would say to you, yeah, John Hume, he never gave me a story. And a journalist after a while gets really miffed with that. You have to listen to this single transferable speech all the time, but he doesn't give me a story and I want to know specifics. Whereas, and the journalists who do feature on screen here, when he took somebody into his confidence, he really could open up. And that's the very same is true of diplomats, Ted. Ted is formerly a diplomat, so.
Could I say that I don't think you can underestimate, he had a vision from a very young age. He tells the story. He was 6 years old when there were 300,000 Americans stationed in Northern Ireland during World War II. There was a whole group right next to his house. He played baseball with him. I wrote about that in this new book. And, you know, he was given the penny and the concept, e pluribus unum. I think it was, he's a visionary, he's a historian, he's a teacher. And I think that kept him going. He would even talk about how that the British, you know, they saw France as their enemy and Ireland was the back door for this enemy to come in. Well, now they're allies, so that doesn't work anymore. His brain power was so amazing, but also he was very convivial. I mean, and Derry is a fun place to be. I mean, Martin can tell you that. In the worst of the troubles, you'd go to somebody's house and there'd be a sing-song and there's a spirit in Derry that buoys people up. And I think that he just always felt that if he could use his brain power, use this concept. He always says he got it from the Americans as a little boy, that wait a minute, you can have your own identity and e pluribus unum and yet be part of a bigger whole. So I think, and his family, Pat Hume, you cannot underestimate Pat Hume. Pat Hume kept him sane, and he used to say he was a package that Pat delivered from one place to the next. And his family, he's very close to, you know, his children, grandchildren. But he was consumed. He had this vision, you know, that he saw it from an early age, and things connected. His first thing was the credit union, simply so that his mother and his aunts could buy school clothes without paying extraordinary interest to the shopkeepers.
You didn't mention the smoked salmon farm. When I was in the consulate in New York in the 70s, he would send out pouches in the diplomatic bag of smoked salmon, which we then had to sell to the Irish-American pubs on 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue. So there was a great smell of fish around the consulate.
We've stepped things up a bit since then, Ted.
So, Kieran, back to you.
What I want to say is, if you watch Gene Kennedy Smith early on, the film there said, I think the phrase was something like, he wanted not a victory. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the consistency of his vision from the 1960s, and part of his vision, the core of his vision, was reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And that, we're still a long way from that. You have 109 peace walls still up across Northern Ireland. And regardless, I mean, he got legitimacy for the view of those in Northern Ireland who want to see united Ireland. But regardless of your vision for the constitutional future of Northern Ireland, it doesn't survive without reconciliation. It's not sustainable without reconciliation. He kept pushing that, and over any sense of victory, over the sense of beating the other, is working with the other. And I think that work, if we can do something to honour him now that he's sadly in so much, such rapid decline, continuing that work of reconciliation is so important.
Well, that was the point I was going to ask you. To what extent is the younger generation in Ireland now aware of how important John Hume is to the peace process?
I don't think they are, to be honest. I had my daughter said to me last night, she's 11, said, I'll go to an event about John Hume, and she said, he was a politician in the 70s and 80s. And then I realised she was reading it off the back of one of the books that was on the table. But even, you know, kids post-1998 generation who haven't seen what we grew up with, the news headlines of every night, you know, one, you know, bombs or attacks of some type, they're not aware of where it came from, and I think it is better that way, of course, but there is risk in the lack of understanding, and there is risk in the lack of understanding of the role that and the risks that people took to get this far. We're still a long way from completion.
Thank you. Any more questions from the audience? Thank you.
Congratulations, Morris. It's an amazing film, and I know it's taken a long time, so well done. Two quick questions. Apart from the obvious, the funding, what was the most difficult thing about making this film? And then the second question is, did you learn anything new about John that you didn't know before you went into it?
Thanks. Probably the biggest challenge was gaining access in a way the highest profile people were production of themselves to get to them and get the interview. That's not to say that people were up to decline, it's just getting through to them. And, you know, I'm glad Steve is in the audience. I probably gave you 4 days' notice. I'm off to New York. I'm arriving in New York, and he didn't know me, but I need a sound man. I think you helped as well, Aideen, with that, pulling together that, because I got notice from Bill Clinton's people that he would do the interview with. So that was very difficult. Finance is always difficult, as you know, with documentaries. What I learned about John Hume, I think it was sort of a deepening appreciation of quite how much he had to go through to accomplish this. What I learned from Hume, actually, my first conversation with Ted over McGraw-Hill, where you were based at that point, that media dimension, right? I had no idea. I'd say at the earliest draft of the film, it probably is absent, whereas by the time I talked to you, it probably was included. That, to me, was really gripping, to get to these editorialists, Karl Meyer in the New York Times, and then through those people to exercise influence and create a new discourse. I think that was a crucially important. There's a huge focus on politics and on Washington in the film, but it's hugely important what people read in the Globe, in the Times, etc. And I think I just want to say thanks to Ted for enlightening me on that.
Thank you. And the editorials, I think, in those days had a much bigger influence than today. I mean, the New York Times editorials really counted in terms of policy. And they still count, but boy, did they count then. So Karl Meyer, who you saw in the movie, wrote many of them for over a decade and was very, particularly after the Out, Out, Out by Margaret Thatcher, was highly critical of her, and that was a very important editorial. I'm sorry he wasn't able to come today. Any more questions?
Ted, I have three questions here, and I'm conscious of time because Morris has
to make
flight.
So those are the last three, will
they? Yeah, okay. This lady, this man, and Erskine.
Thanks, Miriam.
Hi. Just in relation to what you're saying about talking to young people about what happened, I was 4 years old when the Good Friday Agreement came through, And my father was very involved in the peace process back home. Seamus Mallon is a friend of the family. And I think particularly now, in light of Brexit, I come from a border town. A lot of my friends aren't aware of what's happening. I went home for Christmas. In parts of Belfast, there were slight tensions, but this time it's stranger because young people aren't aware of the inheritance or the legacy that's come beforehand. And I think, I don't know, we do need greater engagement in this respect. I come from a town where 500 metres down the road from my Catholic girls' school, there was a Protestant school, and I know no one from that school, and that's today. And I think it's things like this that we need to keep in public consciousness, and again, to talk to young people and ensure that there is a truthful narrative as to what's come before so that we can continue to move forward and retain, you know, the progress that's been made.
Thank you for that question. That's a very good comment. Thank you. We have two more questions before we adjourn.
My comments are really similar. Also, grew up as a kid in Northern Ireland just after the Good Friday Agreement. I was really struck by Eamon McCann at the end when he said, like, there's now tours of the Bogside and John Hume's name's not mentioned. And I think there is, to a certain degree, a lot of revisionism in Northern Irish history. And there's always, you know, part of that solution is education. And I wonder, you know, maybe pushing this back to the Irish government, where do you see the role of education in terms of trying to bring up this next generation of Irish children understanding kind of the role of peaceful civil rights and kind of the role of violence in Northern Ireland and whether or not it was necessary?
Good question, Councillor General.
To be honest, I was trying to think of the answer to that myself. And what we need to do with the education sphere, while the young lady behind you was speaking, I was thinking, where does that fit in? I think that the centenary of 1916, I think, was very, very well handled. At the risk of sounding too crude, we don't have the same celebration of the flag in Ireland as we do here in the United States. And for too many people, the flag was seen as something for international sports matches and for fellow travellers. I think that 2016... somehow brought by the part of education being flags via the Irish Army into every school. If we capture the flag as something for everybody. I mean, that's oversimplification now, but there was something in that. I'd need to know more about what is in the curriculum now. It's a long time since I was in school. So I need to know what is in the curriculum at home about Good Friday and how it is taught. But I do agree there is a need for that education and a sense of the import and scale of what went before. Again, gives the important scale of what happened in 1998, and then the work that remains to be done, whether it's by politicians or church leaders, by teachers, by everybody in the community, to build reconciliation.
The Royal Irish Academy is bringing out a book later in the year called The Road to the Good Friday Agreement, which will go through the sequence of events very much mirroring Morris's film. So one final question, and then we'll...
Just thanks again to the panel. Wonderful film.
Well, this is Erskine Childers of a great Childers family going back many generations.
Thank you. Two quick things. I remember distinctly having a moment with the former consul, Barbara, at the 2016 memorial at the 2016 event for commemorating 2016 at near the Hunger Memorial downtown. And we both said there should be a chair for John Hume up there.
Yeah.
And I really felt his presence. And then the other thing, obviously, for Maurice, Netflix. Yeah. I mean, if you want to get kids on their phones watching this, I mean, you know that. But anything like that for this film would be fantastic. And then the other thing that struck me was that I remember in the 80s, the only Ulster we could get in Dublin on TV. There were four channels back then, TV channels. And I remember thinking and remember my father saying that, remember that when you see anything about the north of Ireland, it's through London. And I felt that strongly in this film, that media played such a part during Hume's time and what we in Dublin were watching as kids. And then, you know, now when all of that is blown down with social media and the, you know, exaggerated media and 24-hour news cycle, it's a very different time. And that's the power of Hume, because you realize he did all this in that very tight media control. And that's it. Just wonderful.
Thanks very much for that. And just in passing, you have beside you Jack Deasy, who was one of the great heroic journalists as well, who wrote for many newspapers and spent, what, a year in Northern Ireland covering the conflict. And, made an enormous contribution to Americans' understanding of the Irish conflict. So with that, we've run out of time. Unfortunately, you've been a great audience. Would you give one final round of applause to the panel and to your...
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life. And thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.